Daryl, good morning to you.
Hello, young lady. Nice to hear from you.
And, Daryl, I appreciate so much this interview today. I'm about to start the intro tape, but I just wanted to note to our audience that this interview is being conducted today, Friday, September 21st. And due to our very busy schedules, particularly today, I'm interviewing my guest, Daryl Sims, earlier in the day for broadcast this evening. And, Daryl, let's begin the interview now, and I'll begin that intro tape. Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Tonight's topics, Daryl Sims' latest research findings and primary research focus on medical and scientific evidence of human and alien contact. Daryl Sims' website can be found at www.alienhunter.org. Welcome, everyone, to the September 21st, 2012 edition of A Global Focus with our featured guest, Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. A Global Focus is broadcast on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network at 107.9 FM New Orleans. Thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these programs possible. Information on the expert guests of A Global Focus can be found at the program website, aglobalfocus.com. Tonight, A Global Focus features as guest Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Daryl Sims has authored with Patricia Gray two outstanding books. The first, Alien Hunter, The Evidence in Light, and the second, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. Daryl is a top international researcher and authority in the ET presence field and has spent the past three decades researching the world of alien beings and their interaction with humans. Daryl's investigative research entails a keen focus on medical and scientific evidence of human and alien contact. Daryl Sims has spent years studying and training in a broad range of areas that would provide him with the full array of skills necessary for his search to find evidence of these creatures. Daryl is a former police officer and CIA operative. Daryl Sims' specialties include certified master hypnotherapist, master NLP practitioner, and board-certified hypnotic anesthesiologist. Daryl's achievements have resulted in worldwide recognition with numerous awards of his expertise in the investigative, ufological, and extraterrestrial fields. Daryl's website can be found at www.alienhunter.org. Daryl, thank you so much for being our guest this evening.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. And again, I just wanted to mention to the audience that this program is being recorded a little bit earlier on the 21st due to our schedules. Daryl, what a lucky person I am to be able to interview you today. This past weekend, you gave a presentation at the UFO conference in the San Francisco area at Santa Clara. The focus and presentation, title of this excellent presentation, was Who is the Alien? His History, Our Profiling, and His DNA Tell the Story. Am I correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Now, Daryl, also I'd like to just start off, and we'll, I'd also like to give the later the URL for this great past conference of this prior weekend. But right now, let's start out with this question. Daryl, you believe the alien, as encountered today, has also visited humans in ancient and various historical eras. Could you tell us your opinions on the aliens who may be represented in both human ancient history and myth?
Certainly. The fascinating thing about the alien phenomena today is that it can be easily picked at or debunked by professional debunkers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and all kinds of people. because they say, well, this is just hysteria and so on and so on. The only problem is we have been able to obtain some photography, some DNA, and other evidence that thwarts that whole view. But even more interesting is the fact that what makes it so difficult to assail is the history of the alien and the UFO phenomena in reference to mankind. You find this phenomena in every culture, in every way you can imagine. And more interesting than all that is that we have ancient photography that shows that information. For instance, in modern photography, you take a photograph with a camera, technology. But in ancient times, like very ancient, like with Native American times, they didn't take pictures because they didn't have a camera. So what they would do is see what they were looking at, and then they would chisel it in stone. It's called a petroglyph. And petroglyph is basically a photograph from a Native American point of view, historically. And by that, you also, in later times, have the photographs of the time, so to speak, in paintings and so on and so on. All through history, you see the same picture of the same alien entities all through history in virtually every culture. That's pretty hard to debunk.
Indeed it is, that confirmation in the archaeological and historical record. Now, and also, Daryl, as an aside, later we're going to be discussing some of your research first, such as fluorescence and also the use of infrared and ultraviolet spectra to find evidence of these aliens. But back to this ancient historical and archaeological record, Daryl, do you believe the aliens use historical and biological disguises to effectively interact with the human populace of a particular era and culture?
I think that you are on the right track in making that assertion. They certainly have covered their tracks in terms of who they are and misrepresented themselves all through history. And this is something I bring up to people in the UFO conferences, is how is it that these are beings of light who function in the dark? How is it these are beings of light and beings of here to save the planet, fix the ozone hole, and do all those wonderful things, and they never did it? How is it that these are beings that are here to do some great thing or help us or whatever it is they're supposed to do, and they have not done that? They simply have hidden themselves and cloaked and masked themselves with screen images to cover the fact of who they really are. But the fact is, if you follow that trail in different cultures and look, and you, if you know what to look for, you will find his fingerprints all over the historical petroglyphs. You'll find him in paintings. You'll find him in the consciousness of people as they discuss it, even historically. And most amazingly to me is the fact that they have, misrepresented themselves as something else. They call themselves fairies, gnomes, dwarves, the wee folk of the Irish people, the jinn of the Islam, and so on and so on and so on. All of them having often a very negative connotation, such as in Ireland, if you're not good to the fairy folk, or the, not, sometimes they may not bring you back. Same thing with the jinn of Islam, the little, these strange little spirit people that might not bring you back if you are in their presence and they don't like what you do. So all of this to me is a telltale sign of the fact that they have hidden themselves and they've not been truthful. They have literally lied all their way through history. And to cap that, this statement, basically mankind is running around in rags and hides and carrying clubs. Now today, we're carrying a laptop and an iPad, and we think we're so much smarter, yet we're buying into the same whopper that we were told 6,000 years ago.
Very interesting points there, Daryl. And, you know what I was referencing, the word biological disguise? there have been consistent research findings which describe actual alien types such as reptilians or amphibians, greys, Nordics. Would you agree that these beings do have physicality? They are corporeal, but they might perhaps be serving a common agenda, and they might be part of the really excellent hierarchical concept you have. Am I correct that someone who sees a reptilian actually is seeing a reptilian in physicality, but he might belong to a particular hierarchy? Could you explain on this? I know you could do a much better job than I.
Well, that's why they have me on, Therese.
Good.
Okay. They're very little. The fact is, I think you're right on target. When you see these entities, number one, I'll be very specific about that for the research types out there. And I've told this to abductees many, many times. I told them this weekend at the conference. I said, if I took a photograph of the entity, and let's say I could take a photograph of you, standing next to you in your event, and you drew a picture of that same entity, there would be a little bit of discrepancy. You would see him a little bit differently because he still has the same controls over you that you may not even know, be aware of. He would look very, very similar, but not exactly. And to reference that, we have got many drawings from people, and what's more amazing is we have gotten some actual photography from a professional who actually photographed several of these entities, in my opinion, a mantis being and a gray-type entity, and they are a little different than the drawings. They really are, but they are astoundingly effective. And they look very similar in that respect. But there are some differences. As to the entities themselves, you are seeing a corporeal being. You're seeing something that is quite real. They leave, as Dr. Carla Turner and her husband would have gladly shown and did show me and others in their presence, cuts, scars, and claw marks, literally, where a reptile had torn at her husband, for sure. And this shows the physicalness of the entities and the physicalness of the beings themselves, which attests to the fact that they are, in fact, entities of some type. And I use the word entity, and we'll cover that later in the conversation, why I use the word alien occasionally because people can identify with that. But the fact is, in my opinion, they're not alien whatsoever. They are, in fact, entities, and they're made, constructed, for the purpose of interaction with mankind.
Very intriguing comments. Now, at the present time in the ufology field, there is a discussion ongoing as to the aspect that some of these aliens might be from other dimensions. And we also have brilliant researchers, such as Craig Lang, who also notes this type of other dimensional possibility from reviewing the cases of patients who have contacted him. Do you think that this is an ultra-dimensional influence? Could it be both? Could it be both physical, cosmic, and also ultra-dimensional?
Yes, sir. That is a statement that is yet to be proven. However, I would like to, with the information we do have, make a little bit different spin on that subject. I think the dimensionality that we encounter, that, in other words, you see them coming in and out of a light form or this or that, some amazing use of craft or some other thing. My thesis on that is that dimensionality, if we use that term for me at this present time, is the mode of travel, not where they're from. And the reason I say that is, generally when you see a sphere, as an example, coming toward you, if it is hard-edged, and I don't mean a UFO necessarily, I mean a smaller, much smaller thing that might be coming towards you, maybe the size of a golf ball or even as big as a small car. Many of these, in fact, are, if they're hard-edged, are actually probes. Not necessarily a UFO in the classical sense that we might speak of. And if that image, that sphere, or whatever that imagery might be, is fuzzy-edged, often that is the entity in transit. Again, we're speaking about his modality of travel, not where he's from. Now, to cap that a little differently, the entity, in my opinion, is from somewhere else, and it's not from another dimension. He's from the local neighborhood, and I mean they're very close. And I believe I have sufficient evidence to warrant that from a NASA point of view, because we have some NASA film footage of that. But again, the question is, are they terrestrial or extraterrestrial or other dimensional? The modality of travel to me is dimensional in that aspect. In other words, they're using something else other than what people would normally use in space travel as an example. And they don't always use that modality, but they do sometimes, for sure. But other times they will literally arrive and come from somewhere in 3D and get here in 3D and never go to that modality of travel of dimensionality. And sometimes they come from within our neighborhood, literally our solar system, and they're not coming from a planet from all likelihood, in most cases for sure. They're coming from a craft, one of which we have some film footage of, that is about 50 miles thick and about 600 miles across. And we have some NASA film footage of other craft that are several thousand miles long.
Daryl, thank you for that information. And I'd also like to stress to our audience, some of whom might just be members of the general public and are not experiencers or related to experiencers, that NASA does have substantial footage, according to many sources. I'd like you to explain that. And also, that concept of fast walkers being tracked by the world's radar, including important systems.
Certainly. Fast walkers is a term that I first heard about and knew. I knew something about it before, but heard about it from a man named Ron Regeer. And Ron Regeer is a DSP satellite specialist, but there are other terms too, which are called slow walkers. Slow walker is the same thing in they're moving far slower and maybe even stopping. To give an example of this, when I met Ron at a conference many years ago in Los Angeles where I was speaking, he came up to me after the conference and said, I'm Ron and I'm a DSP satellite specialist. These are 18 geosynchronous satellites in orbit that see an infrared, ultraviolet, visible light all at the same time. And he said, what I would like to know from you is why you look at the abductees, you look for evidence in the infrared, ultraviolet and visible light spectrum. He said, I understand the visible light spectrum because you're looking for scars, cuts, and things as you well showed. Then you showed us things in the infrared and ultraviolet. He said, no one ever thought of doing that. Why did you do that? And I said, because the alien sees through that black eye patch, so to speak, that cosmic eyeglass, sunglasses, and it allows him, in my opinion, to see an infrared, ultraviolet, visible light, and X-ray at the same time. Hence the reason abductees say, I felt like they were scanning me, yet there was no X-ray machine or anything there, but they were looking inside me. And I don't know how they did that. So a fast walker is, as I was discussing with my friend, I asked him if there were, he'd ever seen any flying saucers with any of this, and he said, of course not, there are no such things. You gotta understand, he was still working for them, so he couldn't use any of these terms. So I said, if I were using the term fast walker or slow walker, and I meant flying saucer, would it be the same term? And he said, yes. He said, though, we don't know of any of those, and they don't exist. And I said, I clearly understand. My next question to him was, the fast walker and slow walker being a, quote-unquote, UFO in my terminology, does the government have record of all the fast and slow walkers that appear on this planet that show up here since these Defense Systems Program satellites came into existence? He said, of course they do. And I said, are those records, are there records? He said, yes. And I said, I would like to obtain those. He said, please don't. He said, if you do, he said, I assure you, he said, they'll be off limits within a very short period of time. He said, tell me what you want and I'll get them for you. He said, they're perfectly legal to acquire. And the second thing, I said, are you trying to tell me that if I had the right dates, right places, right events of abductees of real UFO cases where they were taken, that the United States government in all likelihood has an entire record of that, the proper ascension, declination, time, speed, place, location of UFO in that area? He smiled and said, yes. I said, you're telling me the United States government can prove every one of these cases that they're valid? And he's probably got the data. And it just got worse. And I said, well, what's amazing to me is that these DSP satellites can do this and they see everything here on Earth. It kind of negates the idea of people are making this stuff and everything else whenever you've got a UFO in that exact area where they claim to be taken, and to come back with an implant in them or fluorescence on them, like I discovered in 1960 and 1992 respectively.
Very powerful points, and what a positive indicator as well, that when there is transparent discussion on this subject, there will be further additional substantive confirmation that these abduction events and or other type of alien encounters are happening, are occurring. Now, Daryl, you had mentioned, again, the subject of the different light spectra, and currently more individuals are observing alien craft in significant numbers, as reported or alleged, through use of infrared night vision binoculars and goggles. Now, Daryl, you and your Sabre team have created the firsts of the fluorescence and the use of these spectra. Can you remember some early uses of the infrared spectrum in detecting markers of alien presence at an alleged abduction or other location?
Certainly. We were able to use infrared to detect the presence of a presence of something that was in the immediate area around the alleged abduction scenarios. And this, to me, opened the door widely for to the fact that these entities, no question the UFOs were being seen by us in the infrared range. We saw this many years ago, 1992 era. We saw the craft and the possibility of entities because they were in the infrared range. And that from 700 nanometers up, I mean, you can see some pretty amazing things, and people are doing this, of course, now with their cameras and so on in the infrared range. But by the same token, I use a FLIR, which is a forward-looking infrared device I use this weekend at the conference for with people. And with that, you can detect the presence of an entity if they're in the infrared range. But you can also detect other things, such as signal of an implant, as an example, if a signal was being given off in the infrared range. But there are a number of pieces of equipment that we use to do this. We also use black light, a specialized black light. And in the use of the black light, we found not the craft, but we found the physicalness, the physical evidence of the entity's touch. And that would be 400 nanometers and lower, many times in the area of 267 nanometers. You would actually find a physical color of the entity on the individual if they've been physically touched within the last 48 hours. The fascinating thing about this, as I discovered it in 1992, was that these entities left a fluorescent trace. We call it an alien fingerprint. But excuse me, it's maybe the best way to describe this fluorescence is alien sweat. And they would leave this on the abductee, and it's not detectable, it's invisible. You will not see it unless you check yourself with a black light. And again, this is pretty amazing stuff. Now, fluorescence is used also in the medical field for like fluorescing a carcinoma or a tumor, cancerous cells as an example, is to check their growth and movement and so on. So it is known in the medical field as well in that respect. But where I first discovered the concept of the fluorescence on was not originally on people, but on cattle of all people, of all things. And some cattle were checked with a black light many years ago. And then later, some of those cattle that had a particular fluorescence on them in a particular area and a particular nanometer length were later found mutilated by the alien. So this was our first dealings with the infrared and the ultraviolet range.
Thank you for that information. Very thought-provoking, and as referenced at the beginning, one of the primary focal point of your investigative research is on the medical and scientific evidence of human and alien contact. Now, Daryl, am I correct that other modalities, such as CT scans, perhaps MRIs and ultrasounds, have also indicated perhaps an alien connection or interaction?
It has. We look at the abductees and the UFO phenomena in the infrared, ultraviolet, visible light, and also in the X-ray and MRI CAT scan area as well. The fact is the evidence can be found in any of these areas, and sometimes all of them. Some of these people will come back from their events with lumps, bumps, scars, and things that they can't account for and they can't understand. And one might say, well, they just bumped themselves while they were having a fitful dream. Sometime one lady came back from her abduction account and half of her labia was missing. So I doubt that probably was a fitful dream or it was sleep paralysis or anything else. One man came back, a professional runner, he came back from his event with a large chunk of skin missing off the top of his, hip. And it was about 2 inches wide and 4 inches long, and I saw the scarring from it myself with one of our medical people. This begs to call anyone stupid or insane that would tell these people that nothing really happened, that they've had some type of a sleep paralysis or some goofy idea like that. So we do find evidence of things that have been left in people, and these are quite rare, to be sure, very rare. And anyone tells you that everybody out there has got an implant that's an abductee is simply incorrect. The physical implants are very, very rare. I look at hundreds of x-rays a year, and I simply do not find hardly any of these with any possibility of having an implant. And the few that we have found, we've gone to surgery 24 times to remove these objects, the last one being in Flint, Michigan this year. So MRIs are very useful. X-rays are excellent. But I would like to tell you one brief story of the case that's on our website on alienhunter.org or operationaliendna.com. You can check either one of those out and see these fascinating stories. We have a lady there who's got an implant. It's a film, a short film of an implant in her arm, and you can see her moving it around with her hand, with her fingers. And what's amazing about it is I told her to go get an x-ray there in Brazil, and she did, and the x-ray did not show anything up of this object that's under her arm, that in her forearm, that's very big. It's the size of a vitamin pill. And so I told her, well, okay, I've never seen that happen before. Go down and get an MRI. Now we're going to get hundreds of these little shots of this object. They went down to get an MRI, and it doesn't show up on MRI as well. That's the first time I've ever heard of an implant ever not showing up on MRI or any type of scan like that.
And Daryl, am I correct? Thank you for that information. Am I correct that this might be the same individual, or is there another individual whose a case described anonymously, but as a South American lady had an implant in the brain?
That is correct. She's on the very front page of my book. And that implant that's on my book, implants, that implant is it looks like a lifesaver, a white lifesaver. It obviously isn't. The second thing is that it was discovered accidentally by a dentist. He was, she had had a car accident. They thought she might have broken her jaw on the steering wheel, so they x-rayed her from below her jaw up toward the top of her skull, and they saw this lifesaver-sized type object. It's actually smaller than a lifesaver. It was inside her skull, and she was, they asked her what it was, and she said, I have no idea what that thing is. So the bottom line is that the object was in her skull for several years, then it moved from one hemisphere to the other hemisphere, or was placed in another hemisphere. Then later, it disappeared. Now, amazingly, people say, well, there's no scarring in any of these implant cases. That's not true. Sometimes there is scarring, and in her case, there was no scarring whatsoever in the original implantation of this device in her hemisphere of her brain. However, when the object was removed, there is quite a bit of scarring and cutting on the skull. And as to why that is, I have no idea. Now the object disappeared. No one knows why. And later, this object shows up in her arm.
Boy, the details on that are somewhat graphic and definitely upsetting. Daryl, your two books on implants provide excellent details, and the latest research accounts and information. I know that research is definitely ongoing. Daryl, for you and your team, has the extremely advanced nature of the implants presented a tremendous scientific and investigative challenge? And could you just give us some of the latest developments in research findings and some of the various implant types?
Certainly. Some of the implant types, we go into a system of looking at the implants, and we've categorized them in our own way, so to speak. Some of the latest research alone is an individual pretty high up in MUFON came here and spent a month with me to study some of the objects that we have. And especially to look at objects inside people. Needless to say, he was more than stunned when he saw some of this, some of the fluorescence on some of these people, and some of the implant work we had already done, and some of the objects we had already retrieved. The importance of all of this to me, it shows the physicalness of these events, that in fact these people are not lying. They have been telling the truth all along, and that we're literally ready to confront this phenomena in a public forum, because we feel like that these the circumstances are quite real, and we're just as capable of presenting this, we feel, in a public way, soon, in a public forum, because we still have a little bit more research to do. By that I mean, the research is just beginning with the implant stuff in earnest, but one of the things we're doing now is not removing the objects from people. We're leaving the objects inside them because we want to study the objects inside and see, to check various possible signatures of these objects, communication types, and so on and so on. And the studies are so fascinating of what we've already started in our collaboration that I don't mean to throw this out to your audience in a teasing way, but it's so fascinating. We've literally gone into a legal agreement to keep this information private until it is actually fully studied, and then when that information then comes out, then we will obviously make this available to everyone. I mean, that's the nature of what we do. So that part of the fascinating information is. It's just incredible, and it's so exciting for me to even mention this because the fact that we're going to be able to give people something far more than anything I think that we ever did before, because of the nature of what it is we're going after now. We're not just studying these in general. They're already well established in that sense of the word. Now what we need to do is to provide this in a format where we can do something with this rather than just talk about it, so to speak. But there are all kinds of implanted devices in these people, and some of them are little tiny gold speeders that they're 51% silver, 49% gold. We found as many as 4 of these at a time in a little girl's nose on 2 occasions. Some of them appear to be ceramic type material, like the size of a grain of sand that is egg shaped, beautiful in formation. The end is opened. We think it housed a biological camera. It fell out of the lady's eye after a mass abduction of 8 people. We have some of these objects that are Tic Tac size, 4 of them lined up in a row in the tendon, in the knee of an abductee. We have objects that are, we just removed from the patella or the underneath the kneecap of a lady in Flint, Michigan. And, the surgeon who removed this, an MD of course, did not believe in any of this stuff. However, at the last minute, he decided to physically take possession of the object and not give it back to us. That was a mistake, and my attorney who was present went to great lengths to point out the error of that decision to the doctor. By that I mean he told him, he said, you know, they signed off on it, Mr. Sims signed off on it, you signed off on it, it all belongs to Mr. Sims and his company and the abductees. And if you don't turn it over immediately, I will own you by Monday morning. And of course the attorney released the object immediately. But I think it's amazing that these doctors who don't believe any of this stuff, want possession of it.
Indeed, and I have 3 questions, related questions on this. And I just wanted to note as well to our audience that, and I hope we're not getting too much of a feedback here, that would be the wonderful team, your team of Sabre Enterprises. The Sabre team is one that, and yourself as well as key researcher and director, is a group which anyone can contact, either an experiencer, family member, or a professional who would like to contribute their services to this field. And Before I get back to some implant questions, already your work has been very seriously considered by doctors. For example, you spoke at a Texas Conference of Physicians a few years back. So several fields right now are observing your research, and they're very much waiting on the developments. Daryl, if I'm not mistaken, your group has been one of those who have found unusual elements within these implants. Daryl, is there any unusual symbiotic or communicative link between the implants and the human body?
You bring up a great point. First of all, to comment briefly on the we found 11 different elements surrounding the first three objects we removed from two different people, the first four objects we removed from two different people. And those elements were rather amazing, and this was done, they found out by a Los Alamos Labs, and Los Alamos found these tiny little rods, turned out to be a rare meteorite from the Winbad Satin Structure meteorite, and found out that the physical properties of these were some of them were harder than the hardest tool steel. And they also found a crystalline belt around one of them, which was rather amazing. Had no idea what this was for, and of course you conjecture all kinds of things. We found that objects themselves appeared to be, had 11 different elements that made no sense whatsoever to anyone as to why they would be around those objects. These were about a quarter inch long, about a 32nd of an inch wide, and one of them was in a perfect T-shaped, capital T-shaped formation. Just really amazing stuff. One of the suggestions was that the crystalline belt might be part of something used to communicate by these objects to the alien, so to speak. Number one, we think that the communication that occurs is in most likelihood of a different signature, and that signature, whatever it is, and we're not prepared to discuss that at this time, whatever those signature or signatures might be, are amazingly effective for the aliens to communicate with the implant, and thereby the implant may, in effect, possibly communicate with the human. Some of the things that the implants seem to be good for, from the alien point of view, is that they may in fact be there to alter neurotransmitters in the abductee, as an example. They may be there to specifically those neurotransmitters might be serotonin, dopamine, potassium, and so on. And of course, to what end is it can be better answered by a psychopharmacologist, and their response has been, and in my opinion, would be a simple answer, and that answer is that that anyone that tampers with your neurotransmitters literally runs your show. They are in fact in charge of you if they choose to be, and they are in fact probably using that for that particular control. And perhaps this is some of the reasons some of the implants are there. But basically, in a nutshell, I will say this, that the implants themselves are capable of communicating with people in some way. And I think that primary way that that's done between the implant and the human is, in fact, through a nerve supply, which I predicted to 250 surgeons in the John Muir Medical Hospital in Northern California in the first AMA-sponsored program on medical complications of alleged human-alien contact, specifically implants, which I presented back in 1994. Curiously enough, as I went to this conference in San Francisco this weekend, the same doctor who brought me to all these doctors and surgeons that were there, 250 of them, to listen to this presentation. He was present at my presentation and said, I came to see you again. He said he wanted to know what was the latest in implants and what's going on. And so I filled him in, and he's back on board with us in studying this phenomenon and helping us with that. So we're delighted to have this doctor on board again. Absolutely an incredible man.
Fascinating information. And Daryl, before my next question, any professionals or other individuals who would like to contribute services or time to your organization, can they contact you directly at your site? Also experiencers or contactees or family members with questions, can they contact you right at www.alienhunter.org?
They can contact me exactly at the alienhunter.org or at Operation Alien DNA. Just click on the Alien Hunter or my email there, and I will get your email. I answer all my emails that I actually get. If for any reason I don't answer your email, email me again because I didn't get it. Anyone, professional or otherwise, can reach me there. We do have an online support group for abductees and contactees if you're interested. It's free. We don't charge anything for the services that we do. Our work is philanthropic. The surgeries that we do, I pay for these out of my own pocket or get doctors to help me as best they can. And some of them do incredible work for us. But if there are medical and other professionals out there who would like to help us, I desperately need some DNA people right now. I mean desperately. We have DNA from an alleged alien. From one of my abductees. I took the samples myself, and I also have the samples from a professor. I have both taken, and we're desperate to get these evaluated, looked at. I do have some preliminary reports on the DNA. So any persons able to and willing to, in a forensic setting, we want this done professionally. It's not going to be done behind closed doors. We intend for this information to be peer reviewed, so there won't be any, in other words, somebody will be checking the work, so to speak, to make sure there are no errors. And, because all we're after here is evidence. And if we do have professionals, particularly in the DNA, field, and you would like to assist or help us in this direction, we would be more than delighted to have you. So please contact alienhunter.org or operationaliendna.com, and we would be more than happy to respond to you. And we have things that are coming up this year in the area of implants alone that are amazing, to say the very least, and we have some things, in my opinion, that are absolutely potentially frightening. And I can't discuss that yet because, again, I am under agreement not to. It involves all of our work concerning the implants. It is a staggering study that we're doing, and we're so excited by the interest of some professionals in this that we think that it's going to be a bombshell this year when it's done.
Thank you, Daryl. God bless you in your research. Thank you. I'm sure that your listening audience, experiencers such as myself, and I'm sure here, ICAR, of which I'm a member and also service director, would thank you for this outstanding work. That's very, very exciting, the DNA evidentiary potential. And already you have that DNA evidence. It's been collected, and we have to decipher it. Now, Daryl, on a related question there, you believe that the aliens actually operate as a type of intelligence network. It does seem that aliens are profoundly interested in human biological, intellectual, perceptual, and other traits. Now, you brought up that mass intelligence event, and you mentioned that one of the individuals involved, a participant and experiencer, had what was alleged or what was perceived as an ocular implant fall out. My question to you, and it's kind of a just an ad hoc theory, is it because the aliens might have realized that this group was onto something? They were getting information, and the information could prove negative to the alien activities.
You are more than the, because the case happened in 1992, and it just, and for my audience to understand this clearly, I think I should make do my little alien hunter disclaimer here. I am the alien hunter. I do not chase UFOs. I do not hunt UFOs with a camera. I'm not interested in that. I hunt the pilots. I hunt them that hunted me and hunted my son. Now is hunting, these entities are hunting other people and their children. And I really don't care what anybody thinks about that. That's my business, and my purpose is to hunt the alien. And how I do that is to pursue him. That is not a metaphor. It is a fact. One of the facts of the case is that I developed a Manchurian candidate against the alien. And I did this with a contactee, a lady who volunteered in 1992. And this was done very surreptitiously. She knew about the case. She volunteered for the case. And then I told her, I can't tell you about it. And then we're going to have to do something very profound that I've worked on here for some time. I said, I understand a great deal about the alien's neurology, his physiology, and his morphology, as much as I possibly can. After 40-some years working on this, I said, I know how he thinks, and I think I know how to get to him. And anyway, she agreed, and I put her in a deep trance and installed amnesia on both sides of the memory that I installed in her. The memory I installed in her was something I found inside another abductee who had three blocks inside him. A block is like when a person's being placed under regressive hypnosis, and they're getting this information from the individual, and then all of a sudden they come up against this block and they can't get any further. We have been able to get past these blocks, and in rare cases we've found as many as three of these blocks in an individual. Why would a block be there? Well, I can give you a good, swift, quick answer. You either saw or heard something, or they think you may have heard or seen something you were not supposed to see or hear. Period. As a result, those blocks were usually present. Having been in ex-intelligence, when I got past this block, I heard this information, and I realized if I were them and I were an intelligence community, I wouldn't want anybody to know this. This could uncover some of my business. And therefore, I would no longer, I would be vulnerable and exposed. So I placed that little piece of information inside this woman because they know everything we know. When they abduct you, they go through us like a hot knife through butter. They know everything that's in your headspace. So I placed this in there and installed amnesia on both sides of the memory. So she couldn't find it, and he couldn't get it. This was all a test to see if it would work. I set this information to go off in his presence when he got within 20 inches of her, which I knew he would. At that point, when she came out of her trance, she came instantly out of her trance when he got very close to her in her next encounter about a month later. And she blurted out this information. And she said for the first time in 30 years, she's on 33, in 30 years is the first time I ever saw him have a visible sign of emotion on his face. He was horrified by what I said. Number one, because he knew that information didn't come from her, and he couldn't find out where it came from because of the installation I had in her. And number two, it bothered him because it was a breach in something. We did not know what. I didn't know at the time because I wasn't there. Long story short, we had a mass abduction of 8 people in 2 states and several cities. 2 of the top people abducted was this lady, obviously, and the second one was my senior investigator, where they intended to find out exactly why I did what I did and how did I do it. Well, he didn't know because I didn't tell him. I don't tell abductees things like this. I just do them. And it's with their permission, of course. The point is that a massive craft of 50 miles thick, 600 miles across, and we have apparently the video of it, the smaller craft took all these people to this larger craft where, in my opinion, that's the alien cosmic G implant where the manufacturing goes on of these entities. They make, manufacture, or clone or hatch these individuals there for the purpose of interaction with mankind. So in effect, the alien out there that we're seeing is not actually alien at all, and I'll talk about that later if you want. They're from here. And there's good physical evidence that they are. So the bottom line is that we did use an intelligence technique to get to these individuals, and somebody much bigger than the alien showed up to get upset about it. And they wanted to know how I did it, why I did it, and so on. Well, too bad about that. And we're going to do more than that, obviously. I am the alien hunter. This is what I do. It's not a metaphor. It's an experience. It's not who I am. It's what I do.
Very well said, Daryl. I have several questions pursuing those topics. And before I do, I just wanted to mention that this particular program is being broadcast on the network directed and owned by Joe Montaldo, who is International Director of ICAR. ICAR, too, has done excellent research in the field. And I think you'd strongly agree with me here, Daryl, that Joe Montaldo believes that the aliens' agenda is their own. Now, if I'm incorrect, I will definitely, you know, put a little comment on this tape archive otherwise, but I've always understood him to believe that the aliens' agenda relates to their own purpose. So right now I have two or three questions for you, Daryl, on the alien agenda. And now this is just you as an expert host, and I'm just the little interviewer here. Daryl, first of all, do you feel that the aliens are genuinely concerned about nuclear proliferation and the dangers of nuclear contamination of the environment? And if they are genuinely concerned about the Earth's environment and problems perhaps with nuclear proliferation, is it because the aliens consider Earth and humans as a resource?
That's a very fascinating question. First of all, in reference to Joe and his comments on his view of the alien, I absolutely agree with him that the aliens' purpose is their own. And they've got their own agenda. No question about that. And no one really knows what that is. We find hints of it from time to time. And we piece it together, and that is how we come up with our closest information. Since we don't know everything, we can't know everything, and therefore don't know the entire agenda. But we know pieces of it. And Joe's done some great research, and he's a good man. And I appreciate the work that he's done. He's a great guy. The second part of the question, does the alien care about, let me reference this in a very special way, a generic way, anything. No, they don't. The alien doesn't, in my view, this as me as an individual, he doesn't care much about anything except his survival because of the fact he isn't in charge of anything. What the question, the problem is we in the UFO field, and I'm putting my little UFO hat on now, I can only see with one pair of eyes, it sees UFO stuff. It sees flying saucers, aliens, and so on. It can't see more than that because it doesn't have any other eyes. And in seeing with those eyes, I understand the question. But since I have seven different hats, or to put it in another way, 14 different sets of eyes to look at this phenomena and have for 40 years, a medical hat, a spiritual hat, a Native American hat, a science hat, a profiler's hat, and so on and so on. All these are different sets of eyes. Some of them don't even agree with each other's what they're seeing, but that's irrelevant. The important thing is they see what it is that they need to see from their perspective, and then I can use all that. So with the UFO hat on, obviously, it only has one set of eyes, so therefore probably that's a really good question. But when I put on my intelligence hat, and other hats, and look at all the data for 40 years, it doesn't even make sense. The alien is basically he's made, hatched, or cloned for the purpose of interaction with humankind. He doesn't care what happens to mankind. All he cares about is his own personal survival. That's the bottom line. And he works for someone else, is my point. Now the question is, does his boss, or bosses, whoever they may be, Do they care? Probably, yes. So if the alien cares, it's only because somebody else cares, or because it's part of the game or part of the scam that he's running. The alien, in my opinion, doesn't know the whole story. He only knows the part of the story that he's involved with and for what it is he does. And that is the collection of sperm, eggs, and other kinds of evidence and certain kinds of interaction. He's involved, if you want to consider some of them are literally tape recorders to record the passions of individuals, their sexuality, their passions in fear, passions in other things, for the purpose of replaying it to someone else who literally enjoys that sort of thing. Pain, passions, and so on of human beings, because they don't have that. And I don't mean the alien, I mean he's a tape recorder recording it for someone else higher than he is. Again, it goes back to their bosses, not necessarily who they are.
Powerfully said there, Daryl. Now, I have a question for you, and it's really from my own heart here. Daryl, one of your hats is that of an investigator. Well, you're an investigator regardless into this field, both the wide and individual spectrum. But you have the knowledge as a former policeman of criminal matters, in cases. You indeed serve as a police officer for several years. You also have been in the military. Pardon the rambling question. Just to sum it up, do you believe that some of the activities conducted or reported as having been conducted by aliens are definite transgressions of human freedoms?
I have two hats in that area. Thank you for bringing that up. The first hat is a private investigator hat, which I've had for 30 years. The other hat is a cop hat. Now, that one's tough. That one's in the area you don't mess with it. On a personal level, as an example, as a private investigator, I've arrested had charged 42 felonies in the last 3.5 years against people who steal money from people, or people who steal from corporate circumstances. My point being is that, again, I've walked the walk. I don't talk the talk. There's more to the speech than what we say. When I say I'm after the alien, I mean it. Concerning the cop hat, the answer to your question is abduction is a crime. It always has been, always will be. Look, if we want to put the UFO hat on again, if I go to the aliens' planet, if there was one, and I don't think there is, but if there was, and I go to that planet, do you think that I will be held accountable to their laws or statutes or methods of whatever it is they do? Well, the answer is, of course you will. If I violate those, I will probably be punished accordingly. Of course I would be. Second question, and an obvious one. If they come here and violate our laws, should they come under the same scrutiny? Amazingly enough, people with their UFO hats on generally say no. Why, they're superior to us, so why should they be subject to anything? Well, I have news for you. They are. If they get caught, they're going to go to, I doubt that there's an alien jail, but if there was, I would put him there in a minute. The fact is, they're probably not going to get caught and fried for anything. But the fact is, what they've done is a violation of any sensible person was a violation of human rights. Whenever somebody cuts a piece of you off, or installs an implant in you, if the government did any of this stuff, I guarantee you they would people be out there in droves, in massive riots, talking about the crimes against humanity, and rightfully so. However, if you're only about 3 foot tall with large bug eyes, and you're a cosmic skinhead, you can do whatever you want to, and no one seems to care or mind that you did it. Well, I care, and I mind, and many abductees do. So to break this down for you a little differently, number one, there is an MO, which means the success of a crime. That means that we make a distinction between a crime scene analyst and a profiler. Anyone trained in police techniques can literally analyze the MO of a crime scene. That's basic analysis. It takes a real profiler to examine the signature. When I say signature, what do I mean? any criminal, and that includes, and we're specifically referring to the alien here, has a ritual. The ritual, it by definition means, it is a subtype of a signature and is sometimes called the ritual signature. It literally means the fundamentally unusual behavior or the needs or patterns of the offender. And the third level of this is the signature itself, which is the trademark or the calling card, which reflects a compulsion on the part of a criminal or an alien that go beyond the committing of the crimes, let's say of abduction, to the expressing himself in some particular way that reflects the personality. Not the whole personality in some psychological sense, but something literally about the addictive, repetitive, or the compulsive-oriented part of the personality of the one who's doing these acts. And the big shock and surprise here for all people out there hearing this for the first time is this. The signature of this strange trademark, this expressive, compulsive, addictive part of the personality, the one who does the crime, isn't necessarily the alien who did it. It's the one who sent him. The alien could care less about any of this stuff. He's doing it because he's told to, he's created to do so, manufactured to do so, known to do so, or hatched to do so. That is what he does. But he does it for someone else, and that's the big bombshell of this whole thing. Someone else is calling the shots, and it's that addictive personality. It is that fundamental needs of the offender that's showing up in our profiling that we're finding on these events. We're not finding the culprit to be the alien. We're finding the alien to be, like in a mafia situation, some lieutenant or some lower grade individual doing the bidding of someone higher than him calling the shots. For instance, if somebody in the mafia was called to do something awful to someone, like mutilate them or hurt them in some bad way, he would do that because he's supposed to, but that's not necessarily because that's what he wanted to do, but because he was ordered to do it. And when they're often caught in a trial, they'll say that. This someone above me ordered this kind of a signature done on someone, and that's exactly what's happening here with the alien. And if we miss this salient point, we have missed the part and parcel of what's going on in alien abduction phenomena, in my opinion.
Very strong arguments there. Now, Daryl, I'd like you to explain to the audience here, if you could, case accounts where experiencers have noted strong indications of beings, creatures, who actually seem to be directing the perpetrators of some of these actions, the alien perpetrators of some of these actions.
If a hypnotist will ask, many hypnotists do a good job and asking questions to their abductees and so on, but sometimes they miss things. And I'll give you an example. You know, this is a great hint for those hypnotists out there listening. We've done some fairly incredible work, and others have too. But again, I hunt them. I'm not interested in hypnotizing somebody to find out some information. I'm interested in getting information so I can use it on the alien. I hunt these individuals, and that's what I do. Again, it's what I do. It's not who I am. If the hypnotist, when they're doing hypnosis on an individual, or an individual who is in a UFO event, or they know one's coming up in the future, or suspect that's the case, will ask these questions, you will come up with some fascinating information. If you're an abductee, always look and sense to see if someone else is on that craft that you cannot see. But you will sense that they're there. On the other hand, if you're a hypnotist, when you're asking these people, is anyone present there? And they'll say, yes, two little guys at the end of the table, one at my head or whatever they're describing, or five of them or whatever. They'll tell you all about them and so on. One of the things you might want to ask is there anyone else there that you don't see? And many times you'll get this answer. Oh yes, the one that's hiding over there, we can't see. Well now, the question is, who is that? That's the guy that's running the show. In my opinion, that is, he is usually alien or alien related, but does not want to be identified in these crimes called abduction. And they're, in my opinion, he's hiding out specifically and he's not going to let you see. There are some head entities that are involved in this that you don't get to see very often. But the one who hides out, that the many abductees understand, they sense him, or they may see a little part of him or just a glimmer of him in the dark. He will be in the background. Sometimes some of these people even describe a bear-like or a hairy creature in the background. This is often Sasquatch himself, because they're part and parcel of this show as well. And he's not supposed to be seen on the craft, because he's not supposed to be an alien. But he'll be there. But the entities that are higher than the alien, or higher than the ones we've just spoken about, these are the ones that, for the most part, only under the rarest occasions will you ever see them. And if you do see them, they will not show up in the literature. And the amazing thing is that there are a few rare people who have seen them. And the ones who have seen them have wished to God that they didn't. Not because they're horrific to see, particularly, but some of them are. But more particularly because of the damage that they will do to you for making that error.
Intriguing information. Daryl, now we're 1 hour and 11 minutes into this interview. I have there two more question areas. Could we go to about 1 hour 35 or 1 hour 40, or should we take a break now? We are on air as I speak. I'm sorry, we're being recorded as I ask this.
I'm fine to go on until your break.
Excellent. And that will be about 1 hour 35 minutes or 1 hour 40. It's now 1 hour 12 minutes. Before we head to the topic of what an experiencer can do, what proactive steps they can take if confronted with these experiences, I was very interested as well, Daryl, by the fact that your research strongly indicates a possible alien interest in the human capacity to fight for their own species sovereignty. Are there research indicators that the aliens are particularly intrigued by the human capacity at self-defense and preservation of human free will and self-determination at both personal and cultural levels?
There, on a personal level, it is astounding to me that abductees, that's not a correct statement, that many contactees give up their humanity. They will give up their humanness, they will give up the mankind. And I hate to say this, but we find it over and over and over. In lieu of the alien's agenda, they will do what the alien says. They will obey. They will not, if they're told, if they're in the intelligence area, and they are a quote-unquote contactee, in many cases, they're going to give that information up to the alien. The abductee, on the other hand, will fight, and I can better describe this in this way. A contactee is a person who has been contacted. They may not have been abducted much or often, but they've been contacted for sure. The contactee, in my opinion, experiences after a while a alien Stockholm syndrome, and they become a pawn of this phenomenon. And they will do whatever the bidding is of the aliens, the entities. They will. And that includes betraying mankind or even themselves if necessary. This is part of the programming of contacteeism. Hence, you'll find them doing everything in the world, from channeling to anything you can imagine to try to stay in contact with their cap force. On the other hand, and I call these people, and to make sure people don't think I'm disparaging these people. I am not. I'm just saying this. These are the facts. What I am saying is this. that these individuals are like honeybees to me. They are kind, they're sweet, they're gentle people for the most part, and they they think the funny little man in the white suit out there stealing their honey is supposed to. They think it's his right to steal it, that that's all okay, and it's no big deal. It is a big deal, and if your honey, whatever it's called, you want to identify that honey as, that it's still theft. And the abductees, on the other hand, are different. They will fight. They are often Native American, Indian, Irish, Celtic. They're fighters. Their genetics prove it. And they don't like what's going on. And you mess with their children like they did in mine, and you will create problems you wish you hadn't done. And maybe that's good, because now they have a nemesis of some kind. The fact is that the abductees, in my opinion, are killer bees. By that I mean, if you try to steal their honey, they're not impressed with your funny little white suit, your large black eyes. They don't care. That's irrelevant. And the fact is, you're going to pay the price of your theft, and you're going to get stung many times, and I hope they get you as many times as possible. You deserve it. Sorry, that's just a little abductee humor there. Until they get your kids, you don't really appreciate that mentality, I don't think. So the fact is that that's the mentality of what you're dealing with, and I don't lay it all on the alien only, because at some point, humans have to be responsible for their own behavior. And you say, well, they made me do it. Well, no, they didn't. They programmed you to, but you went along with it. When you don't rebel, if the red Chinese came in here, or the Russians came in here and did the same thing to Americans and put you in a re-education camp, you're still ultimately responsible for your own brain. I'm sorry, people can't just go out and fry it for you. And you say, oh, anything I do now is, it's all their fault. It's not mine. I don't buy that. You're still responsible for your own life. And I think the alien is upset with human beings that are abductees, that are Native American, Irish, Celtic in particular, because the fact that I don't think they're here to change us into little honeybees. I think the problem is they can't change us into little honeybees, but they're doing everything they possibly can to do that. They don't have to worry about the contactee, because they're already in their pocket anyway. They already run their show. Those people don't need an implant. They don't need their neurotransmitters altered. They're already altered, and they're already in the tank for them anyway. It's like some of the people in our political spectrum today. They don't care what the facts are, left or right side. All they care about is the fact that I'm in the tank for whomever, and it doesn't make any difference. They don't care even what happened to the country. It's more about what my side say. And that mentality to me is totally destructive. I abhor it. I really do.
Thank you for those comments, Daryl. And here I'd like to delve into helpful advice for those who believe they are experiencers. Daryl, as been acknowledged by several in this field, many experiencers do suffer from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder, and rightfully so, given the horror of some of these events. Daryl, what different steps and modalities should experiencers consider? And what is the proper use and effective assistance provided by, for example, hypnotherapeutic regression and also neuro-linguistic programming?
Okay, it's a very good question, because I did a presentation and a tape, for the University of Texas at El Paso, two of them, as a matter of fact. One of them was on hypnosis and what you should know about hypnosis before you do that. Before I let anybody work on my brain, I guarantee you they're gonna know their stuff. And I think you should do the same thing. Just because somebody is a hypnotist doesn't make them a hypnotherapist. They may have a piece of paper that says they are a hypnotherapist, but they're not. They're a hypnotist. A therapist is another area of business that that therapists rightfully belong in. And a hypnotist is a person who hypnotizes you, and they may be real good at it. Anybody can learn to hypnotize anybody. Therapy is something far different, and you don't get it by practicing hypnosis on people. That's not therapy. In fact, that's a mistake for you to even assume that if you're doing it and you're a hypnotist. So if you're wanting hypnosis, make sure that you understand that's what you're going to get. You're going to get hypnosis, not hypnotherapy. There are some therapeutic side effects and benefits from some of the techniques used in hypnotherapy as well. Yes, I understand that totally. It still doesn't make you a therapist. I have therapists and MAs, MS, CW, and PhDs and psychiatrists that come and get training from me. Yes, they do. And the reason is because I can show them how to enhance their therapeutic skills greatly through the use of NLP. And the fact that I've worked in a clinic for 4 years that had about every kind of case you can imagine, from people with amputees to with phantom pain to you name it. The point is that many abductees, when they come back from their events, do experience a post-traumatic stress syndrome to some degree. And one of the best things that can happen to people, believe it or not, besides hypnosis, is the following. Find a good support group that loves and cares for you, period. I have one online. If you don't want to use that, you find one somewhere else. I have one online, and there are people from around the world that are on that. It doesn't make any difference if they're there for support, not for brainwashing. We don't try to make everybody into little abductees or little contactees. That's not what it's for. But we do debate those issues very, very bluntly and profoundly. But we have both on our site, and people are not derided because they choose to believe in one side or the other. It is for support, and that's the whole basis of it. Support will give greater mental health benefits to people than virtually anything I've ever seen. The second line of defense a person might want to do is to go through hypnosis, but my first advice to you is the following. If you don't want to find out what happened to you, if you can't deal with that or don't want to deal with it or not going to deal with it, don't open Pandora's box. Because when you open that box, you're never going to get it closed again. You're always going to be an abductee. You're always going to be a contactee, or whatever it is they find in there, that's what it's going to be. And if you want to do that, fine. I had to do it because I was conscious during my events. I knew what was going on to some degree. I saw what was going on with me. I later understood a lot more about it. But the point is, there's a great deal of help out there right now in the first level and support groups, number one, and number two, and hypnotherapy, if you choose that. In my view, and this is just me personal, and I'm not picking on anyone, I would not allow anyone to work on me unless, number one, I trained them, because I know what it is that I need specifically, and I know what abductees need. I've worked over 1,500 cases worldwide and in various languages. And second, I would require that they had at least a master's level in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and knew how to integrate that with hypnotherapy, and they were skilled in therapeutic technique. If they did not have at least those two qualifications, at least those two, and I prefer more, if they don't have those two, then in my opinion, they're not going to work with me. I also want them to be able to detect a lot of things about individuals. They have to know if I'm hallucinating or not. They have to know how to not hypnotize my screensaver memory versus my actual memory. They must know the difference between recall and memory. And if they don't know those basic things, you ain't working on me. Not now, not ever. Dr. Carla Turner said I was the only one who would ever work on her other than Barbara Barfalik. And I know why she said that. And it was more than hypnosis. It had to do with other things. But my point is, that's my minimum requirement. I don't know what yours is. But whatever yours is, support group first, in my opinion, is the best thing that can happen to you. Those people will love and care for you, because they've gone through the exact same thing you have. Whether negative, whether positive, whether whatever, they've already been there, and they'll help you. And it's for you.
Thank you, Daryl. Now, Daryl, as far as a further proactive response for an experiencer, do you ever advocate the use of intelligence gathering techniques, and does that involve a complex modality? What is your opinion on this?
When I refer to the technique of, for instance, creating a Manchurian candidate, this was not taken lightly, and this individual was selected over a long period of time, and I had to develop criteria that I knew that were effective. I do use certain abductees for the purpose of gathering intelligence for me on board that craft. I do. And they volunteer for this. I know that there's a good chance that the alien's going to find that data and information on them. I can still retrieve it. And these individuals, I tell them in advance that if they find out what you're doing, there is a good chance that they're going to be very unkind to you, psychologically and sometimes. And if people are still agreed with that, and there's only a few handful of people that do this to, then I will consider using them in this phenomenon. The techniques that we use then there are based on the fact that I understand the mentality and the neurology, in my opinion, of these entities. I think I have proven that to myself over and over by the mere fact that we came back with great intelligence that produced, in one case, a mass abduction of 8 people in 2 states and several cities. And a craft showed up 50 miles thick to 600 miles across. That is no small feat. And the bottom line is I got to them. And me and the individual. And, of course, they weren't aware of what they were doing. But the point is that this is actionable intelligence. And these entities are not godlike. They are not all-powerful. They make mistakes. And we can capitalize on them if we know what we're doing. So, yes, I do that in that way. I do enjoin anyone on board that craft who's going to be on board that craft, or if you think you are, to start watching out for things. And there are simple techniques that you can do to even thwart your abduction if you don't like it. Some of them are quite amusing, and the alien gets real upset with them. Believe me, they will. They get very upset because they don't like the fact of you taking charge of your own life, and especially in the middle of an abduction where they are in charge.
Boy, that sounds very worthwhile pursuing, and thank you for those details. Now, Daryl, I have one final question, and then I'd like you to take the show out. My final question is, indeed, as many know, you were interviewed by the X-Files movie staff, and they actually believe that both your career and experience reflect a rather Agent Mulder-like individual. Daryl, do you feel that current movies such as Prometheus and television series such as Falling Skies indicate a sincere interest in the media world as to this subject matter? And are there any aspects of these current films or TV productions that have, perhaps, a segment of factual versus theoretical basis?
I can answer that in several ways and will, and I think your audience will enjoy it. Number one, some friends of mine who are NASA abductees, when I say that, they're NASA people who are abductees. One of the things they told me and other folks one night was that sometimes they're actually flown out to Hollywood and their screenwriters get to interview them. Guess where screenwriters get a lot of their information and ideas for their next TV shows and movies? Duh. That's number one. Number two, the bottom line for Hollywood is this. Money, fame, Academy Awards. That's what it's all about. So they're going to do whatever it takes to get that. Number three is that do some of these movies, TV shows, and so on have a spin and literally a takeoff from something that is realistic, or at least they at least point to that. I think that is very true. The X-Files wanted me on their trailer for the movie X-Files simply because I was very truthful. In fact, there were three people interviewed that day, and two of which are very popular in the UFO community, and they're on the opposite side of the fence of me about this phenomenon. And the X-Files people told me they didn't believe either one of them. They thought they were making it up, and they used a word, something along the word of BS to describe it. And I said, well, what makes you think I'm any different from them? And they said, well, you always reference yourself in particular ways that scientists, people in the medical field might, who use a Socratic method of thinking. And the fact is that you're hunting these entities, and the profoundness that that's had upon you in the life of your son. And we think that if there was a Mulder, you'd be him. And I said, well, that's a nice try, but I don't buy it. But the point is that for whatever reason, they were impressed with that. But the reason they didn't use my part in the TV show, in the movie, is because I gave them cases of what the real Mulder was like. And the cases I used were people who had literally been skinned alive in their beds in Brazil, people who had their eyes surgically removed and later became insane because of their physical alien contact, and other people who had horrific events, such as two children in Dallas, Texas, who died from their abductions. And I asked them, I said, you want to put that on the X-Files or steal that like you did the fluorescence and the implants and other things that you and several other people have done on the Internet? And they laughed and said, we had no idea. We had no idea. I said, well, this is stuff that doesn't sell in the UFO community. So it's stuff we don't often talk about, because nobody wants to hear that aspect of ufology. We want to hear about, we want our little two eyes that look like little, our UFO hats, so to speak, our UFO eyes. That's what we want to see things with. We don't want to see the entire picture. We want to see the UFO picture, the part that we can deal with and can and like to deal with. And that's okay. But the alien hunter has to look with another six set of eyes besides those two.
Eloquently said, and to me, you are the consummate researcher, warrior, and hunter. And just God bless you, Daryl. Also, I can personally attest, if you have any question for Daryl, he is extremely quick to get back to all communications. He and team are just superb. And now, Daryl, before I just give my final goodbyes to our audience, do you have any final comments? Again, I must mention your excellent site, www.alienhunter.org, or just simply alienhunter.org. Daryl, further comments here?
Certainly. In a future show, if you want to do that, I will tell you where the alien come from and give you some DNA evidence on that, if you'd like. But for final comments itself, I simply would like to say that the map is not the territory. And if we have good maps, we know that the territory we're looking for out there is going to be well described by that map. But the fact is that some of the maps that people have are not the territory, they're not even good maps, much less of the territory. So I think that we have to understand that, that the map that we have out there, the maps that we currently have realistically in ufology, is the following. UFOs are just maps. They're not the territory. Implants are maps. They're not the territory either. Certain kinds of crop circles, about 10% of them, because those are the only ones that are actually real, are just maps. They're not the territory. The menu is not the meal. It may look like the meal, and I don't care how good it looks. I promise you it won't taste like the meal. So don't get the map or the menu mixed up with the territory. The little waiter that brings you to the restaurant, so to speak, the alien, He's just a map, too. He is not the territory. And if you think that he is, in my opinion, you missed the boat by at least 15 yards, and you need to get at least six other sets of eyes to look at, because you're going to miss this whole story if you think that the map of the territory of the alien is actually him. He's nothing but a transgenic who was constructed and made from interaction with mankind, and he's been doing a pretty good job of that, although he makes a lot of mistakes. But he's not in charge. And I thank you for your time, and this is the Alien Hunter signing off.
Thank you so much, Daryl. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today.